we don't always slip passively into the infinite inning. We are very often accessories in our own fate. Sometimes we choose the exit ramp into the void. It's well signed with warnings, but we don't always see them. Sometimes we also don't see people, though they're standing right in front of us. Trevor Bauer of the Cleveland American League team is obviously a talented pitcher, drafted third overall in 2011 behind Garrett Cole and Danny Holson, but ahead of, among others, Anthony Rendon, Francisco Lindor, Javier Baez, and George Springer. The UCLA right-hander made it to the majors the very next year and grew up in public, making gradual improvements in his pitching that culminated in a 2.21 ERA in 2018. Socially, the learning curve has been even steeper. Politically alert, inclined rightward, he's been keen to pick fights on Twitter. That's his right. But earlier this week, he got carried away during a different sort of online encounter. Bauer was bantering with Houston Astros infielder Alex Bregman, and a young woman taking this in said, referring to Bauer, "My new least favorite person in all sports. I guess she's a Bregman partisan." Well, that's not much, right? This is not the harshest criticism a person in public life has ever received. Hell, I've gotten a lot worse and I'm not anybody. But Bauer couldn't let it go, and he kept coming back at this person. She initially tried to give as good as she got, but he went on and on, even going through her back catalog of tweets to find things to throw up to her, to embarrass her with. She stopped. He kept going. She said he had made, at that point, over 40 tweets that referred to her even after she had at least temporarily blocked him. She later revised that number to 80. I did not count them. I am just telling you what was said. And told Bauer that she was, quote, very creeped out by him. He kept going. He said she was just seeking attention. That was strange. But as you know about social media, the problem is not just the players on the field in any confrontation, but those who come off the bench to participate in the argument. She had fewer than 1,000 followers. She still has fewer than 1,000 followers. He had approximately 135,000. Things spiraled and snowballed as they do. It is impossible to reason with a mob, which is a vast number of people that share one brain and there just isn't enough to go around. And it is, of course, hard not to feel cornered, to feel threatened, to feel on some very primitive level that the tribe has expelled you and they're going to leave you on some rock that is submerged at high tide or tie you to a tree and leave you to starve. I don't want to exaggerate what happened to this young woman, but it is true that the terror that one feels in that situation can be existential. There's an excellent movie from 1936 or so called Fury. It was directed by Fritz Lang and starred Spencer Tracy. And Tracy played a guy, an innocent man, who was misidentified as a murderer, and he's attacked by a lynch mob and locked into a burning building from which he barely escapes. This, as you would expect, embitters him quite a bit, and at one point he says of his experience, "I could smell myself burning." If you've had a social media mob come after you, you too can smell yourself burning. And unfortunately, we have the suicides to prove it. Once Bauer's vendetta became public and people in the media started writing about it, he sort of apologized, tweeting, "I often defend myself against internet trolling, bullying, and slander. My responses to fans are good-natured. I do not encourage any of my fans, followers, or friends to attack, insult, or harass anyone on any social media platform or in real life. There is no room for that in the world. I have been made aware that some of the interactions related to a specific Twitter exchange may have had a negative impact. That was not my intention. I will wield the responsibility of my public platform more responsibly in the future." So closes another chapter in the annals of social media overreaction, but it was also a missed opportunity. You can always try to de-escalate instead of being aggressive, turn the other cheek, and if the person on the other end of the interwires goes ahead and slaps it, well, at least you tried. Very often, the problem with online interactions is that you're not real to the other person, and vice versa. Sure, there are sociopaths out there who will slap the other cheek if they were to meet you in real life, But most people, if they're not suffering from narcissistic personality disorder, are fully capable of understanding that you're real, you have feelings, and that they are capable of bringing joy or inflicting pain on you, depending on how they treat you. Again, there are sadists who understand that too, and they revel in their ability to inflict that pain. But I think, I hope, that they're in the minority. Normally, that is, I think they're in the minority. Online, we are more susceptible, all of us, even perhaps the most saintly of us, to behaving like them for a couple of reasons. First, in the relatively short history of the internet, the trolls have been so disproportionately loud that we've been conditioned to think that any interaction that seems remotely hostile or critical must be an encounter with one of them. And secondly, it's easy to hurt someone who's just an avatar, who you don't know, even if that avatar is a picture of their face. They do not register cognitively, I think, on your emotional radar in the same way that a person who is in the room with you would. As Bauer's reaction demonstrated, words are not a person. Words are a stimulus. And if that stimulus, for whatever reason, causes you pain, and obviously he felt wounded or pricked by those words in some way, and at that point you're going to react. The only way to defeat that impulse is to pause and to remember, with any seemingly hostile gesture more ambiguous than a death threat, that it's a real human being on the other end of the line. And perhaps at that point, if you should care, you can use your empathy to deconstruct their responses or their reaction to you and try to understand why they said what they said and come to some kind of middle ground meeting of the minds, which you would think would be the whole purpose of the internet, the Tower of Babel aspect of it. It can be a community or it can be an arena, and that's up to, well, not just you, but to everyone involved. You know who talked about this of all people? Jackie Robinson. In his book, Baseball Has Done It, he wrote about an off-the-field encounter with someone who hadn't really seen him, despite having been on the field with him. Robinson said, "In 1954, I boarded a plane with an umpire who had known me 8 years earlier as a rookie in the International League. At that time, I was following Branch Rickey's wise advice to turn the other cheek to provocations. By 1949, I was established as a big leaguer, and Mr. Rickey said, 'You've earned the right to be yourself, Jackie. You've given so much to the game that you are now in a position to comport yourself as other players do. You're on your own now.' From that moment, I defended myself against anti-Negro insults with all the force at my command. Now, in 1954, this umpire sitting beside me in the plane asked, 'What's made you change your attitude, Jackie? I liked you so much better when you were less aggressive.' 'I'm not concerned with your liking or disliking me,' I retorted. 'All I ask is that you respect me as a human being. Your dislike of my aggressiveness has no effect on me. I'm after something much more important than your favor or disfavor. You should at least admit that you respect me as a man who stands up for what he believes in.'" In the interest of accuracy, I should disclose to those of you who have not read the book that I shortened what was a much lengthier rejoinder, though I in no way changed its meaning. Robinson was communicating with that umpire on two different levels. First, there was a surface explanation. My newfound aggressiveness is about standing up to prejudice. But beneath that, there is an underlying premise that is hugely important, because without accepting that premise, without Robinson having put it out there for the umpire to understand, his ability, the umpire's ability, to grasp and perhaps even sympathize with what he was doing and why he was doing it would have been impossible. He was saying, "You cannot understand my actions if you consider them in a vacuum. You have to accept first this premise that I am a person, that things, forces have acted on me, and now I am reacting to them. If you only consider my actions' impact on you, then you've cut me out of the picture entirely, and you're just not going to get it." We often shorthand Jackie Robinson as a ball player, a pioneer, a crusader for racial equality, but the logic of what he said in that instance has nothing to do with any of the above. Or I should say that the argument applies whatever his cause might have been, accepting that I am a person with needs and feelings independent of yours, not necessarily more valid or urgent, but also not necessarily less, is the prerequisite for us to achieve understanding on any topic that we might try to discuss. Robinson wrote his own epitaph. He said, "A life is not important except in the impact it has on other lives." It's a wonderful sentiment for all of us to try to live up to, but it requires us to acknowledge that there are other lives. That's what Trevor Bauer missed this week. I'm Stephen Goldman. This is The Infinite Inning. Welcome back to the show, number 88 in an ongoing series. Collect them, trade them, send in all your box tops, and redeem them for a cool infinite inning decoder ring. You know, that's just brilliant of me. As if this show weren't obscure enough at times, now I'm going to drag old radio premiums into things, and I can't imagine that anyone wants to have a long conversation about what they used to give kids who mailed in to Captain Midnight or the Little Orphan Annie show. I will say, though, this wasn't a radio premium, but if you mailed into the original Captain America comic book in the early 40s from Timely, this was Marvel before it was Marvel, you could join Captain America's Sentinels of Liberty and get a cool badge. I would like to have one of those badges. But an authentic 1941 badge in good condition probably goes for, $1,500, a couple of grand, which is a bit rich to me for a little gewgaw, which portrays Captain America in tin or some such and not in, precious jewels or metals. So, as always, we're off and running with a laser-like focus on our topic du jour. That topic is not the Yankees don't care what their fans want, and that's why they signed DJ LeMahieu this afternoon. No, that happened too late for me and my guest to get into it. That guest being Craig Calcaterra, the ringmaster at NBC's Hardball Talk, who makes his return to the show after, two-thirds of a year away. Not for any particular reason, because I'd love to talk to Craig all the time. He's really smart. But I'm sensitive to imposing on people and keeping things fresh, and also, as you will hear him discuss, he has his own broadcasting activities going on via NPR. That said, we had so much conversation that one episode couldn't hold it. This thing has been sliding towards 2 hours recently. Cliff Corcoran's last appearance got there, and there is a fine line, I think, between something that gives you, the listeners, a surfeit of great content and a self-indulgent program that never meets its deadlines because it takes forever to edit. So I'm trying to get that under control. That said, I promise that I will get that additional material out to you one way or the other in the near-term future. In the meantime, Craig and I kicked around the off-season so far, such as it has been, exchanged stories about awkward clubhouse encounters with ballplayers, and delved into whether we are headed for some kind of massive labor conflict in baseball, given the way that the owners have really bottled up every avenue through which they would normally be spending. Before we move on to additional notes about this week's program, one quick one about last week's program. You will hear Craig list the Milwaukee Brewers among the teams that are not pushing their advantage during their current competitive window. 2 days after we had that conversation, they signed Yasmani Grandal, which is exactly the sort of thing they ought to be doing right now. Don't fault Craig for not knowing that, because you are listening to Craig Calcaterra's past, not Craig Calcaterra's present. It's all just one big science fiction story. The other thing is just a detail I want you to keep in mind. I told a story to Craig that I don't think I have told on this program about a clubhouse encounter that I had in which I got yelled at quite a bit. And I got yelled a couple of heights and weights that apparently I was expected to have known before I walked into the room. I did not remember as I was telling the story, and I still don't, what heights and weights exactly were shouted at me. But I want you to keep in mind, and I'm intentionally being coy about this so as not to ruin the story, but one player was 5'8 and 180 officially, the other was 5'11 and 165. Partially blind or not, at no time in my career have I been a carnival act wherein I guessed your height and weight for money. I don't know that I'm adept at that, but as you listen to the story, keep in mind that difference of 3 inches and 15 pounds. I think having that number in mind, I have even more empathy for myself, the character in the story in this instance, but you'll let me know whether that's fair or not. Finally, my other note, more than one person let me know that I misspoke talking about Bill Ballew, the writer who is not voting for Mariano Rivera in the Hall of Fame Derby because he feels that saves are overrated and closers are misused. I'm not going to relitigate that now because Cliff and I spent a great deal of time on that last week. You can listen to that if you haven't heard it already for the actual argument. The only correction or amendment I want to make to that is that Ballew is not filing a blank ballot, which would count essentially as a vote against everybody on the ballot and damage all the players down ballot from Rivera who are trying to get in or are trying to just cling to the ballot. But he is not filing a ballot at all. So for counting purposes, he just doesn't exist. Poof. That is something that I understood perfectly well when I opened my mouth to speak, but as so often happens, what you say is not always consistent with what you know or what you intend. And so whereas I still disagree with what Ballew is doing, I do apologize if I misrepresented the impact of his gesture. Before I roll Craig in here, I want to continue the theme with which I began the episode, not to chastise Trevor Bauer, but to mention some possibilities to him and to you. We talked last week about the Hall of Fame, and I talk about it with Craig more this week, and one of its faults is that the very idea of a higher class of history makes you pay attention to the wrong things and the wrong people. This is exactly the same as the way that the great man theory of history makes you lose track of the people who didn't necessarily get their face put on a stamp or carved into the side of a mountain in the Dakotas, but were just as important to the victories or defeats of all the guys with the marble monuments. As Casey Stengel said when he won his first World Series title, "I couldn't have done it without my players." And that's the truth, but he's the one in the Hall of Fame. Now, he was fascinating, but for some of the other guys who actually have plaques, I defy you to find one interesting thing to say about them, because as much as we pretend that we don't enshrine people for numbers, we do. And those who are out often have better, more interesting, and more instructive stories than those who are in. Tommy Henrich is one such player. He's not in the Hall of Fame because he didn't have those big career numbers that allow voters to avoid the labor of thinking, or of storytelling for that matter. He got a late start in the majors due to being buried in the minors by Cleveland. He was in the war for 3 full seasons, and he also had a bunch of injuries, so he only played in about 1,300 games, making about 1,300 hits and 183 home runs. He was an excellent player, though. His best season came with the 1948 Yankees, ironically, one of the few Yankees teams of that era that did not win the pennant, it just missed. He hit .308, he had 42 doubles, a league-leading 14 triples, 25 home runs, he walked 76 times, led the league with 138 runs scored, and hit 4 grand slams, which at the time tied a record. He was a very good glove in right field, a very good base runner, and a career 132 OPS plus guy. He was also a team leader, one of those players who would tell the younger players who came up with the Yankees that he expected to have a World Series bonus at the end of the year, so be serious. Stengel described him this way: "He's a fine judge of a fly ball, he fields grounders like an infielder, he never makes a wrong throw, and if he comes back to the hotel at 3 in the morning when we're on the road and says he's been sitting up with a sick friend, he's been sitting up with a sick friend." As I said, he didn't get anywhere near 3,000 hits or 500 home runs, but I don't see why those arbitrary numbers should mean anything to us, because he's part of the story. One-third of one of the great outfields of all time with Charlie Keller and Joe DiMaggio. He was on six World Series teams. And in Game 1 in 1949, he led off the bottom of the ninth of a scoreless tie and hit a walk-off home run. He's the only player to have done that. That is, 16 players have hit a game-ending home run in the World Series. But, and it's up to you whether you feel like this makes what he did clutchier or not than it otherwise would have been, he's the only one to break up a scoreless deadlock that way. That's all just for background. None of that is why I want to mention Henrik in relationship to Trevor Bauer. I was thinking about serendipity, happenstance, the kind of good luck that comes to you only if you're open to it. There are many kinds of good luck. You can find a $50 bill on the sidewalk because you happen to be looking down at the right moment, but your attitude, your state of mind, has nothing to do with that. It just means that someone else was unlucky. Conversely, you could also bump into someone in some random, unanticipated place, just walking down the sidewalk, say. And as it turns out, that person is going to be one of the most important people in your life. But that's not going to happen if you're self-protective and hostile. And nowadays, there are sidewalks all over the place, some of them hypothetical, but for all that, no less real. On September 7th, 1940, the Yankees were playing at Fenway Park, and Henrik, batting in the top of the first, hit an RBI single and slid awkwardly, trying to stretch it into a double. He tore a ligament in his knee, and that was that for the year. Now, as opposed to today, when you could accidentally saw your own head off, and the hospital will treat you and put you back on the street the same day, in 1940, a wrecked knee meant a month in the hospital. Henrik went ahead and made himself comfortable, as I suppose we all would. He had a radio brought in so he could listen to music and, of course, the ball games. And friends of his in the restaurant business had top-quality food delivered so he didn't have to eat that rotten hospital stuff. As a result, his room became a popular place for the staff to hang out when they had a free moment. Henrik was not only a celebrity, but he was a nice guy, and he had that radio, so you dropped in, you caught some tunes, you had a quality roast beef sandwich. One of the staff members who started to spend some time with Henrik in that room was a nurse who was actually freshly, more or less, arrived from Ireland. Her name was Eileen O'Reilly, and it turned out she liked Henrik for his conversation as much as for his sandwiches, and he liked her too. Now we need to skip most of a year ahead. On Sunday, July 6th, 1941, the Yankees hosted the A's for a doubleheader before a reported crowd of 60,948. Before the day's baseball activities began, the Yankees held a brief ceremony in honor of Lou Gehrig, who had passed away on June 2nd. With Gehrig's widow Eleanor watching, catcher Bill Dickey and manager Joe McCarthy unveiled the monument to Gehrig that still exists in Monument Park in the current iteration of Yankee Stadium today. New York City's mayor, Fiorello LaGuardia, made some brief remarks, and although these are off the stem of my story, I want to share them with you anyway. This monument is dedicated with honor as a tribute to the private character and public service of Lou Gehrig. Lou Gehrig was a Native American, the son of German immigrant parents, and he typifies all that is fine and good and gentle and courageous in American manhood. He gave to baseball all that he had. He brought to public office a keen intelligence and gave that same devotion and loyalty to the public service that he gave to baseball. He will be remembered as long as baseball remains. Lou Gehrig will be appreciated as long as good government exists. And just to contextualize those remarks somewhat, remember that once Gehrig became sick, it was not the Yankees who employed him, but the city of New York via LaGuardia. That's the public service to which he was referring. They went on to play the game. The Yankees swept the doubleheader, which must not have been surprising as the A's were not a very good team that year, and the Yankees were peaking. They would go 25-4 in July. Henrik played both games. He went a combined 3-for-7 with 2 walks and 2 runs scored. And with the conclusion of the second game, baseball shut down because it was All-Star time, and 6 of Henrik's teammates headed off to Detroit for the festivities, but not Henrik, although in the future he would be a frequent All-Star himself, because he had a more pressing engagement. For him, the solemnity of the Garrig Memorial must have been a rather incongruous prelude to a much happier occasion. On July 7th, the next day, he married his nurse. Both were 25 years old, except Henrik was 28 because he was fudging his age for baseball purposes. But nonetheless, they were married for, are you ready, 67 years. Or, alternatively, Henrik could have thrown her the hell out of his room the first time she did something that annoyed him, and both of their histories would have been very different. This is an example of what I meant by the kind of luck you have to have a certain level of awareness to unlock, and the kind of patient disposition that doesn't screw things up before you even know that something good is happening to you. Because, obviously, it doesn't always reveal itself right away. That Henrik possessed that kind of disposition benefited him not just in his relationship with his future or potential wife, but in his relationship with the fans too. And it showed in the way that they treated him in that pre-social media era of mostly in-person interactions. On August 30th, 1942, he momentarily broke a baseball game. It was, again, the second game of a Sunday doubleheader. The Yankees were hosting the Detroit Tigers. In mid-August, with the war going on, Henrik had applied to serve in the Coast Guard, and he was called up at the end of the month. As Henrik came to bat in the bottom of the seventh, the public address announcer went a little further than normal. He didn't just do the traditional Yankee Stadium, "Now batting number seven, Tommy Henrik, number seven," but instead said, "Attention, please. This will be the last time Tommy Henrik goes to bat until the war is over." And at that point, the game stopped. 50,398 people got to their feet. Parenthetically, retro sheet says 30,398. The paper said 50. The Yankees usually did pretty well on Sundays. They had a big park. So use your own judgment. The applause went on and on. Detroit's pitcher was Dizzy Trout, and he held the ball. Henrik shouted, "Just pitch already." He was embarrassed, and Trout, to his credit, said, "Nuh-uh, soak it up. You're never going to have another moment like this one." Henrik tipped his cap. He was trying to make it stop, but his eyes were misting up, and he needed more time. Finally, he got composed. He stepped in. Trout wound and dealt, and Henrik knocked the ball into center field for his third hit of the game and his last safety until 1946. Many ballplayers served, hundreds. Not all of them got that kind of send-off. Henrik had earned it just by the way that he comported himself. We all feel bad sometimes. We all feel a spirit of evil take hold of us and we lash out. If you can resist that impulse often enough, you'll see opportunities for affection that you otherwise might never have known existed. And if we change our ways, I can't say that you're never going to feel bad again, but I can say you're going to feel better. As always, we will pause for a moment here so you can mull that over. And when we return on the other side, it will be in conversation with Craig Calcaterra. I'll see you then. My next guest returns to the program for the first time in 8 months. He's the longtime lead writer of NBC's Hardball Talk, and lately he's branched out into hosting NPR programs. He has more cats than the Rays have relievers, and to borrow from Denny O'Neill's description of Batman, he has the compassion of a Buddha and the relentlessness of a shark. He's Craig Calcaterra. How are you, Craig?
I am flattered, and you are too kind, Steve.
Oh, no. I only call him like I see him. So before we turn to the baseballness of everything, you have recently, at least once that I'm aware of, hosted an NPR show. And I don't know if that was a one-off or there's going to be more of it, but I listened to it. You did a great job. And I was wondering how that came about.
Well, it was a two-off. I've hosted it twice. it's interesting. And the show is, it's the Only a Game show. WBUR in Boston produces it, but it's on NPR all over the country. And it's their, you know, it's, I think even their tagline is, you know, NPR's take on sports, which is everything that you can imagine what that means, which is we talk about everything around sports and, you know, make it nice and palatable to people who listen to NPR on Saturday morning. It's a great show. I've been listening to it for, you know, 20 years, probably. They do a segment every week where they bring on two sports writers or sports people of some kind, and they talk with the host, and it's called Three Stories You Should Know. And everybody just brings up a story that was in the news in their bailiwick that week. I always have a baseball story or something. And it's only a little 10-minute segment where we just chat kind of happily about how interesting this weird story was this week. And so I've done that for a couple of years now. And so I got to know the people there a little bit. Last summer, the host, the longtime host of Only a Game, Bill Littlefield, retired, and he's writing books and doing fun things now. And so Karen Given is the host who has taken over. She's been a producer on that show forever and ever and ever. But she also likes to produce her own stories, and because she's been doing that for a long time, and that's the real fun thing for her. And so they were looking for someone who can come in sometimes and maybe guest host. And they didn't ask me to do that originally, but I had a story of my own that I had written on my personal blog that they said that might work for a produced story for a segment in the show. And hey, if you're going to do it and we're going to put you in a studio and you're going to do your voiceovers, why don't you just guest host the show this week too? And that'll give Karen a chance to go do something else. And like, okay, that was great. And so I did that once. And then a second time, Karen was on vacation. So I was sort of like the Joan Rivers to her Johnny Carson. They had me come in, and I go to the studio, the NPR studio here in Columbus, Ohio. And do my bits. And it's come out pretty well both times. I hope they'll have me back. I'm going to be back again this week on the little three segments thing. And they've told me if I ever have another produced story to do, I can do it. And it's just a lot of fun. It's very weird. But the weirdest part of that is, as you know, if you listen to NPR, is you have to have an NPR voice. And you'd think having an NPR voice would be easy. But no, it takes some cultivation. And you have to have the strategically deployed vocal fry. That's not easy. And they've been beating me over the head with Ira Glass books in order to get me to do that. But it's been fun.
And yet, I wouldn't say that Ira Glass is exactly that guy. You know what I think of as the quintessential NPR voice is actually not NPR, but the voices done by the Molly Shannon was one, the two SNL cast members in the sweaty ball sketch.
Yes. And see, that's really the NPR voice. They're like parodying what people think of the NPR voice, but it's way more on than actual any real NPR voice. If you want to get back to the topic of stereotypes have, you know, basis in reality, it's more real, even though you can't find that in nature. The Alec Baldwin, well, you know, who else does it really well is Dan Castellaneta, who does Homer Simpson's voice, was the NPR-ish host, I think, on Parks and Rec, maybe, or some other show. He played an NPR host, and he does that absolutely perfectly. And it's weird because you get this cadence, you figure it out, and the idea is, you know, you want to be friendly. And I'm completely slandering the NPR people, by the way, right now, because they don't come to you and tell you, hey, do the NPR voice. I just have this in my head. And they said everyone has it in their head when they come in and start doing this stuff for the first time. But, you know, you want to be friendly, but you want to be serious, but you want to be funny, but you want to have gravitas. And all those things are completely at odds with one another. And what ends up happening is you transition from a story about a guy who was murdered over a vintage baseball into something about orphans, you know, doing something fun. And you forget when you're supposed to be happy and when you're supposed to be dire. And that's kind of hard because you read these scripts like 17 times and you completely lose context in them. And I find myself doing the laughing voice over this guy was killed. And that's, you know, all I'm saying is the radio professionals are real professionals and us amateurs are doing the best we can.
It's true. And this extends, I would think your empathy or your learned empathy, your gained from experience here would extend to some extent to sports broadcasting too, because I've found, I mean, I felt this way all along, but particularly since I've started doing this and I find that I get tongue-tied about once every other syllable and I'm able to mask that to at least some extent with editing. But if you are Joe Buck, to use a person who divides the nation in a lot of ways into opposing camps, as particularly when he calls baseball. And I'll be honest, I don't love his baseball calls at all. But just the act, whoever it is, John Sterling, drives me up the freaking wall. But to take a 3-hour broadcast and fill it with words and not stumble over your tongue and always have something to say, the amount of preparation, the amount of professionalism, it's a physical skill in a way. See, I just did it. I hesitated. That's not something that somebody with that level of training would do.
It's amazingly hard. And, you know, I think when we're all doing our armchair criticism of the broadcasters, we probably forget that. And look, I don't want to say they're above criticism. No one's above criticism. Some guys are better than others and some women are better than others and everything. But you do have to remember that it is a hard job. It's not nearly as easy to do that, I wouldn't guess, as it is to sit back for 3 hours and nitpick when they screw up. Now, that's okay for stumbling over words, and that's okay for mixing up a name or something. It's not the same thing when you're, you know, Joe Simpson or somebody, and you just decided you hate Bryce Harper for reasons that aren't clear, and you go on a jag about that. That's not about the job being hard. That's just having poor judgment. But yeah, it is really weird. And the NPR things I've been doing, they're hour-long shows, but it's like 5 segments, and each one, you know, might be 8 minutes. And in the 8 minutes, I have 6 minutes of talking, and it's scripted, and I get multiple takes. And that's fairly easy. Doing live radio or TV for 3 hours with unexpected things happening in front of you, and you instantly have to process it and make it interesting and communicate it well, that's got to be really, really hard.
That's why, and I do think this is a fair criticism apart from the actual act of doing it, is that the level of preparation comes through really, really loudly. And I know that people are diehard fans of a local team. When they see that team on the national broadcast, they start to pick it up because they'll know information about the team that very often the national broadcaster, having just dropped in the day before and maybe had like a quick meeting with the manager or some such, he just doesn't have that same grasp. But you know, even the local guys sometimes are less engaged than somebody else with another team.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I like watching local broadcasts way better anyway. I like the regular season better than the postseason. I like the local games better than the national games. And a lot of that has to do with there's just a cumulative knowledge base, and not just even a knowledge base. Like, you know, the inside jokes, right? I mean, every fan base has its own stories. Like, we've all talked about how so-and-so is better when he's never seen a pitcher before. And that's a thing that if you follow the team all the time, you know this. An announcer can just reference it without having to explain it all. A national guy, if he's super prepared and knows about it, has to go through and explain the whole thing. If he doesn't know about it, he misses it completely. And then, as so often happens, especially on ESPN or whatever, they won't even go into that stuff. They'll just default to whatever the national news is of the week. It just makes it really, really hard. And the familiarity, the preparation, just the knowledge base, it just makes all the difference. And everybody always wants to go to Vin Scully. I understand that. And Vin Scully is a very, very high bar. But when you're doing a one-man booth and you know he had just pages and pages of preparation and research, and of course he had people helping him with it and everything, but having that at your disposal, there's nothing better than having preparation. And I just couldn't imagine trying to do that job without all that kind of investment.
I don't know if I've ever confessed this publicly before, but when I was a kid and learning my basic baseball, this was more or less pre-cable television. It was before having the option of watching every single game if you'd subscribe to the right things. And in the last years of Vin Scully's career, I took great advantage of being able to just dial up Dodgers games whenever I wanted and listen to him. But when I was, say, 10, 11, 12, whatever, he was the host for me of the NBC Game of the Week.
Yes.
And that was my only exposure to him. And I have to tell you that as a kid, I didn't like him. And part of it was, I think, that the level of sophistication was actually too high for me at that age. And the other part of it was that he was paired with Joe Garagiola.
Yeah.
Which was like you had this guy quoting Shakespeare on one side of the booth and then this guy doing dad jokes on the other side of the booth. And it was just the most clashing fingernails on chalkboard thing. And it went on for years. And I don't understand exactly who they were trying to appeal to, but it must have been like the worst of all worlds for everybody.
You know, it's weird as anyone. I mean, that's the same for me. That was my first exposure to Vin Scully, was on the Game of the Week. And if you weren't in Los Angeles or in California, that's probably your first exposure to him, at least if you're old enough to not have had MLB TV or whatever when you're growing up. And yeah, I don't think I ever had this sense of, wow, Vin Scully's really good during that era. He was the guy who was on Saturday. And at some point, I think Bob Costas was in there too. And I probably, if you had asked me back then, I would have said, well, Bob Costas is better just because he sounded younger.
Oh, me too.
Yeah, sounded younger. He was hipper. He understood stuff better. He was more matter of fact or whatever. And it wasn't until I got to be able to see Dodgers games and Dodgers broadcasts, and that was relatively recently, it's within the last 10 years, when you could sit and listen to or watch a lot of Dodgers games, that you really start to understand what the appeal of the guy was.
I'll make a comparison, which is I've never really developed a great taste for wine. I prefer wine that tastes more like fruit punch. And what people told me is, no, when your palate becomes more sophisticated, you'll appreciate the dry stuff more. And it's just, I'm not a big drinker, so it's never really happened for me. And maybe it just won't ever happen for me. But I think in that sense, the erudition of Vin Scully, I had to grow into it.
Oh, I think that's absolutely the case. If anything, I was a little spoiled because my first exposure to baseball and baseball broadcasting was Ernie Harwell on the radio. And, you know, Ernie Harwell is considered by most people, hey, he's right up there with Vin, and obviously not as erudite and all of that. He was definitely a lot more plain spoken, but the same sort of deal, just this wonderful voice, this companion who just had complete mastery of what was in front of him and just embraced you and brought you into the game and everything. I have that. What do people do that had to grow up listening to some of these guys that are just terrible, who I won't name? I was spoiled. You know, Vin Scully, it's like, you know, and again, it's like someone who's only had Bud Light their entire life here have this, you know, Chateau Neuf de Pop. It's fantastic. You know, come on.
I grew up with Phil Rizzuto, and I mean, there was something to that too. It had its charm. Maybe it wasn't particularly hard hitting, but if you like cannoli and knowing whose birthday it was, then it was okay.
Everybody likes what they like growing up. If you ask anyone, you ask them what team do they grow up with, what broadcaster do they grow up with, they'll defend them fiercely, even if they know they're objectively terrible. They will defend them fiercely. It's just, that's what you knew. That's what you came into baseball with.
On a more dour note, I hate to do this, but I've been thinking about this all day. Are we headed, do you think, for a major labor crisis in baseball? And here's the reason that I ask that. It's January. We're having another slow winter. Bryce Harper and Manny Machado, who realistically all 30 teams should have an argument for bidding on because they're so young that even if you're in a down cycle now, in theory, if you're serious, you won't be in a down cycle for the length of their contract, which might be 10 plus years. But more than that, I feel like what we're seeing is the owners have, as of this year, or I should say 2018, have changed federal law such that minor leaguers have no chance of getting paid, those that didn't get huge bonuses, which is most of them. They already control player salaries for the first 2 to 3 years. Then arbitration can blow those salaries up, but not to the same extent as if they were free agents. They don't hit free agency until year 6. And now front offices understand, hey, with free agency, we were paying players mostly for past performance, not future performance. So we're going to sweat all those guys out, wait till the prices come down and sign them all about 2 minutes before camp opens. And we're really just seeing the kind of end of players being able to get their full chunk of the game's revenues. I don't know if Tony Clark will be the guy to seize on this and fight it, but are we in trouble that way?
You know what? We're in more trouble of a work stoppage if the players do the right thing than if they do the wrong thing. And I mean, you hit it on the head. The market has shifted to younger players. The front offices know this. And it's something I wrote this week too. There's also this whole thing that exacerbates the situation in which Major League Baseball revenues are far less dependent upon winning baseball teams than they ever have been in the past. You don't have to draw, you don't have to win to make money as a Major League Baseball owner. That's because of ancillary revenue from corporate sponsorships, from the BAM tech settlement, from the gambling partnerships, from luxury seating and tickets, which you have to sell far fewer of. The incentives to field the winning team are far lower. The incentives to pay players is far lower for the reasons you just suggested. And of course, we have a collective bargaining agreement that disincentivizes spending in a number of ways, whether it's the qualifying offer, whether it's the arbitration system, whether it's the competitive balance tax or luxury tax. We have a system right now where everything tells a front office that you don't have to spend money and everything squeezes players out of dough. Okay, so players are complicit in this and part because they made some bad deals with the collective bargaining agreement. I get why they did that. Baseball players were on a war footing from the late 1960s through 2002. And 2002 was the last contentious collective bargaining agreement session, and they just avoided a strike by a day. But from you know, for 30 years and change, they were on a war footing with Marvin Miller and Don Fehr. That is exhausting. Okay, and I know it's not the same players over that whole period, but the whole idea that we are every few years going to gear up for war with the owners can be exhausting. They finally got past that in 2002. They beat back the salary cap for what they thought was for good. They called the bluff on contraction. They won. The players won, or so they thought. Then the owners got smart. Rob Manfred came in as the chief negotiator for Major League Baseball, and he got smart too and realized that it's way better to take a little bit here and a little bit there over a long period of time than to try to be a Bond villain and take over everything at once. And over the last few collective bargaining agreements, the players got complacent and the owners got smart. And the owners got concession after concession without having to give that much up and brought us to where we are now. And players, for their part, because they didn't want to be on a war footing anymore, started to think about the luxuries that they could get. They thought about the lifestyle things. They thought about, do we get extra days off in spring training? Do we get an extra seat on the bus? You know, do we get a hotel suite and other things? And people offer that stuff up as sort of to slam the players and for them being dumb. But it's not dumb. It's understandable.
They're real things.
Yeah, they are real things. And Tony Clark gets a lot of crap thrown at him for being perceived anyway as caring about those things and not the others. But he works for the players. He has been responding to what the players wanted. Now, is it the union's job to maybe educate the players a little bit more and to warn them about this is what's going to happen if you agree to this and that? Of course. And there's a lot of fault to be there, but this is where we are. So, next collective bargaining agreement. If the players want to fix all of those problems you mentioned, they have to go after some very big ticket items. You either or have to, you know, shorten the team control period from 6 years to something less, or make arbitration be something that happens right out of the gate, or get rid of the luxury tax, or get rid of the qualifying offer, or any combination of those very major things that serve to depress salaries right now and serve to push off players' free agency until they're past the point of being valuable in the eyes of current front offices. Those are all major, almost, I'd say, nuclear options, or just, you know, very, very big things that's going to cause a huge fight. The only tool that the players have at their disposal, realistically, yes, they're at the table. They can bargain. They can ask for whatever they want. They can trade away a few things to get something else. But the ultimate tool that they have is the tool to strike. The only way that they can either strike or make a credible threat of a strike, which would also give them power, is if they are all on the same page, if there is solidarity, if everyone is prepared to go to war if they have to. There is nothing that suggests to me, based on anything I've read, anything I've heard, people I've talked to on and off the record, there is nothing that suggests to me that players are on that footing right now or even are close to being prepared for that. There is no solidarity within the union about those sorts of things. There is only limited, at best, communication from the top to the membership in the union about this is what we have to do if we want to make a lot of headway on those issues. Could this stuff be happening behind the scenes very quietly? Sure, absolutely. But people that are involved in this that I've talked to say that we're just not there. And we're, what, 2-3 years now away from when things have to get very serious. So will there be a labor stoppage? I don't think there'll be a work stoppage, because I don't think that the players have their crap together enough to actually make a credible threat of a strike in order to get the things they need. I think what we're going to see is a little bit of incrementalism, but I think the owners have the upper hand, and I think they're going to have it for a long time, and it's going to take a very bold statement from the players' union and from players' union's leadership to change that.
If I can make a weird, not wholly appropriate analogy that struck me as you were talking, one of the things that the New Deal accomplished after the Great Depression is that it changed the optics of poverty such that, and this affects us to this day, when we had the 2008 crash and several years of really poor economic performance and high unemployment, as opposed to what happened in the 30s, many people were able to stay in their homes. Poor people today can often afford televisions. they're not necessarily starving because of food stamps. So on one hand, the safety net did what it was supposed to do. It provided a safety net. But on the other hand, it mitigated the harshness of what was happening and disguised it to a lesser extent for those who were experiencing it. But for the rest of us, we didn't have to confront it as much. The players, by any standard of what most people are making, even if they aren't getting their fair share of the game's revenues, are doing very well. And I imagine that that creates a certain kind of complacency where you start saying to yourself, how many millions can I make? How many generations, unborn children untold, who I'm going to set up for life that I don't even know? Whereas that's not the point. It's the principle of the thing. Going back to even Babe Ruth talked about this in any walk of life, that the ideal is that you are compensated to the fairest point of what your labor is generating for whoever you are working for in whatever field you're in.
Absolutely. Look, Marvin Miller in 1967 could go into a team's clubhouse in spring training and say, of you 25 guys, I know 12 of you have to work blue-collar jobs in the offseason to make ends meet. That's not good, and that's not right. And that's not a hard argument to make to people in order to get them on your side. You shouldn't have to go sell cars in December in order to feed your family when you're a professional baseball player. It's very easy, relatively speaking, to get people on your side when that's the situation. It is in many ways a conceptual and an intellectual argument now to go into a major league clubhouse and say, the owners are making X billions of dollars, you are entitled to X percentage of it, and here's where you fall short of what the percentage was 20 years ago, and blah, blah, blah. I mean, these guys are all comfortable. I mean, even the guys making the minimum salary with very little job security, I mean, they are making over $500,000 a year. It's very hard to tell someone or to convince someone, especially when a lot of these someones come with a generally conservative bent anyway, whether it's culturally conservative or politically conservative. It's not a radical group of people, baseball players. It's hard, I would imagine, to convince them that it is worth laying it all on the line, possibly striking, becoming very unpopular in the public's mind, and not being able to do what you love more than anything else in the world, which is play baseball for a little while, in order to get this sort of what is to them a conceptual gain. The injustice, however we want to characterize it, may be just as great, but it's practically not the same thing. So yeah, I can imagine it is a huge struggle to get a bunch of professional baseball players who are living pretty comfortable lives to do something dire in order to improve themselves. But, you know, these guys get legitimately mad. At the same time, look, they're not idiots. These guys know that the free agent market is terrible. They know that a lot of these guys are getting squeezed out of the game probably earlier than they should be, and that a lot of young guys are not getting the kind of money they should be getting based on how much they're relied upon and what they're producing. So I don't want to say it's, you know, it requires moving heaven and earth to get these baseball players to want to really go to the mat. But it's not as easy as it might have been 50 years ago.
Who wants to be a millionaire?
I don't.
Have flashy flunkies everywhere?
I don't.
Who wants the bother of a country estate?
A country estate is something I'd hate.
Who wants to wallow in champagne?
I don't.
Who wants a supersonic plane?
I don't.
Who wants a private landing field too?
I don't.
And I don't, cause all I want is you.
You're listening to the 1956 versions of Frank Sinatra and Celeste Holm singing Cole Porter's composition, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, from the MGM picture High Society. The picture, which also starred Bing Crosby, Grace Kelly in her final movie before getting married, moving to Monaco, and quitting the film business, and the great, irreplaceable Louis Armstrong, was a musical remake of The Philadelphia Story, which starred Cary Grant, Kate Hepburn, and Jimmy Stewart, and is equally worth seeing. Although High Society has one extra thing going for it, which is that it's the last inarguably great score that Cole Porter ever wrote. He was coming to the end of his health, and I'm sure this is not a coincidence, his enthusiasm at this time. We will pause for a break, and then I will be back with more conversation with the highly engaging Craig Calcaterra. Hang in there, please.
Chauffeur, do I want...
No, sir.
How does it affect us, the spectators? Because between some of the forces you talked about before, in that revenues are not necessarily connected to winning as much as they used to be, or even to just plain bodies going through the turnstiles, which are usually closely correlated, we also have this period in baseball, which we call the winter, the hot stove league, basically. Other people call it the winter for other purposes, as it turns out. But the whole point used to be that you would do things to galvanize season ticket sales. You may or may not have been incredibly serious about competing, but you were going to move some pieces around. You were going to add a gate attraction somewhere. And not only do teams seem less psyched about that, but earlier in this offseason, we've heard less about it lately, a team like the Red Sox, which at 108 wins is one of the best regular season teams of all time, and then rampaged through the postseason, there were rumors that they were looking to shave payroll. And that's a really depressing message. Sorry, the fun's over. We did what we came to do. Now it's time to retrench and be the Royals for a while. It seems like it's against the natural order of things somehow.
Oh, it is. And, you know, the Red Sox are still going to be good. But, like, look at the Indians, right? The Indians, by all rights, should be dominating the AL Central for several years in either direction. And they have been doing well. But they're a step below the Red Sox and the Astros and the Yankees, right? I mean, we know, even if the Indians cruise to the AL Central title, that they still have some work to do to do more. And if you're an Indians fan, if you're any kind of a baseball fan and your team's in that situation, gosh, you want your team to do more. We have got some talent right now. We just need to take one more step and then we can do it. No. The Indians are, again, they're doing the same thing. They want to deal either Corey Kluber or Trevor Bauer, perhaps. Their outfield right now consists of, like, you know, three guys from the Lubrac. It's depressing as hell. I live in Ohio. I have a lot of friends who are Indians fans, and they are all depressed. There is no enthusiasm, even though this is a team that is really, really good and that 2 years ago was in the World Series. It's viewed as a lost opportunity to them. And so what I think has happened is, and you know, we can shorthand it because you and I both know what we're talking about here, is there's been this movement on for years where fans have gotten a lot more savvy and they start to view the team's prospects through the front office's eyes and say, oh yeah, that's good. We should rebuild, or yeah, we should watch the payroll. They're all armchair GMs now instead of, you know, armchair managers. And for years, fans have gotten on the same page as front offices when it comes to cutting payroll and stuff. And I think generally they still sort of identify with the front office and think players make too much money and all that kind of stuff. But there's a shift going on. It's a subtle shift. And I think it's happening though. Whereas before they would say, okay, yeah, it's smart. We need to rebuild or retrench or deal that guy before he becomes a free agent. Fans are starting, that I talk to anyway, are starting to say, well, this is stupid. Why aren't there are all these players out there? Why aren't we trying to get them? It's not like, you know, 1998 where everybody's like, we should spend $100 million on so-and-so. But there is this idea of we should be improving incrementally as a team and we're not. Or why are we thinking of trading guys when we're in our competitive window? That's depressing to people.
Right.
And there's more of that. And this whole idea that front offices kind of don't care, or they at least seem to not care, that's alienating people very slowly. The savvy ones first, but it's going to alienate more people over time. We've got a good third of Major League Baseball teams that aren't participating at all in the free agent market in any meaningful way, maybe more so depending on what your definition of meaningful is. That kills enthusiasm. This is probably an outdated metric, but when I first started writing for NBC back in 2009, people would always ask me what I did in the offseason. And I would say, are you kidding me? The offseason is our most traffic time. And literally every single year,
yes,
November, December, January, we got way more traffic than we get in the regular season because people are excited about what my team might do and all the hot stove stuff. It's a little different now, but not that different.
I haven't seen the metrics in a while, but at Baseball Prospectus, during the 10 years or so that I was associated with that publication, traffic would literally drop by half on opening day. And yep, would not recover until we started doing prospect stuff in the off season.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, December was every year our biggest month at NBC. It might still be. I don't look at the metrics as closely as I used to. And Thank God to NBC. Thank you guys very much for making me not have to do that. But it's a situation where fans get excited in the offseason because the old saying goes, you know, everybody on opening day has a chance. And we know that's always been a lot of BS, but there's something to it at least. There's a little bit of excitement. Even if your team is not very good, it's a new season. Whereas now the whole idea that the offseason is supposed to be a time where we retrench and the spring is supposed to be a time of renewal, I think Major League Baseball teams have really undersold how important that is for fans. And I think if we continue on this path for a few more years, you're going to get a lot more apathy in the fan base. I have friends who are Yankees fans who are sitting out right now, Yankees fans of all people, who are just resigned to having it be a kind of a blah offseason. Where are we now if that's the case? It just seems ridiculous to me.
I did a MLB Now show today at the MLB Network, and one thing that came up was the New York Mets and some of the moves that their new general manager has been making. And there were reasons to praise some of those moves. In the last week, he's added some good depth pieces in Keon Broxton and J.D. Davis. But I kept saying, but this is one of the big market teams. And what came back at me, if you watch the show, was, well, are they? They're in New York. Yeah, they are. Well, they don't think of themselves that way. But is that a self-fulfilling prophecy? I mean, it's a team that in some years has drawn 3.5-4 million fans. They don't do that right now, but they're also not trying. And so there's a chicken and the egg thing here where you go from gambling and trying to get all the money that you can get to just getting enough to get by. That's not a good reason to go to Queens for one thing, but it's not even a reason to turn on the television at this point.
Maybe the Mets aren't the best example just because I think there's been a resignation in that fan base for several years for reasons that have nothing to do with the macro issues in Major League Baseball. It's just the Wilpons ownership and everything has treated that team a little bit differently. But that idea has, I think, expanded to a lot more teams. I mean, you mentioned the Indians. You mentioned the Red Sox. There's no reason in the world that the Red Sox should not have just been going for the throat this offseason. And, you know, I don't know, who's their bullpen going to be right now? I mean, you know, it's very strange to have teams like that just don't seem all that interested, especially when you've got two generational talents out there on the free agent market. I mean, if I'm Milwaukee right now, and I know Milwaukee's not a big market team, but let's not pretend that any team in Major League Baseball is poor. You know, how are you not capitalizing on a great season and trying to add that extra piece and trying to, you know, add either a big pitcher or another bat? If you're, you know, Colorado and you've come kind of close, but you're doing it on a very weak offense for a team in Colorado, especially when you've got Arizona rebuilding, you've got the Giants and the Padres down in the dumps a little bit. How are you not going for the throat to try to get at least close to the Dodgers and get yourself, you know, squarely ensconced in the wild card conversation? Any team. Seattle's sell-off really angered me, to be honest. I mean, there are only a few teams in the American League who are really seriously trying. And while I know there are structural problems with the Mariners, you know, it was an 89-win team. And who thinks the A's are going to win 97 games again? How do you not at least try to gear up a little bit more for a couple more years to give your fans something to be excited about? I think it's pretty depressing. And I think Major League Baseball is at least believes it's immunized a little bit from the effects of that. Fine. Fans don't show up. Doesn't matter. We're still going to make great money. That's a problem.
Can I say, by the way, and I don't know, I mean, this is different from whether it's a great idea on a baseball basis or not, or whether they have the money, but wouldn't it be awesome to have Bryce Harper in Colorado just to see what would happen with putting that level, assuming he recovers closer to his peak than he was in 2018, but wouldn't it be spectacular to have that kind of player in that kind of environment? Because it seems to me that sort of one of the great ironies or unfairnesses of things is that with the exception of the odd Larry Walker or Todd Helton to a lesser extent, we really haven't had the perfect mating of this great offensive environment with the great offensive player. And damn, it would be cool to see.
Yeah. And you know what? I think if you said that, if we're sitting around a bar with a bunch of baseball fans, people would be like, oh yeah, well, that'll never happen, because people have just internalized this idea that certain teams aren't going to be interested in certain players or certain teams aren't going to spend a lot of money for a big free agent. Well, let's put that aside for a minute. Why shouldn't the Colorado Rockies go after Bryce Harper? Why shouldn't the New York Mets go after Bryce Harper? Yeah, I know they're not going to, because we know how these front offices operate. But why shouldn't they? How exciting would that be for fans? How much of a difference would that make on the field? And yeah, we might be able to, you know, let's run some numbers and decide if wins per whatever, you know, dollars per, runs above, wins above replacement are going to make this make sense. I don't care. I'm putting on an entertainment product on some level. Yes, I should care. If I'm a general manager, I have to care. But just broadly speaking, if I'm a fan of the Colorado Rockies, I think I'm entitled to ask my front office, hey, why are we not trying to do something like this? The front offices don't even answer that question anymore. People don't ask, and they don't feel like they have to answer it. The standard answer that they'll give is, we're going to make efficient moves, or we're going to do this, or that's not in our philosophy, or they'll give this cloud speak about, you know, whatever their front office philosophy is, that local media doesn't push back on at all. National media very rarely does, because we're all too busy tripping over ourselves to say, hey, that was a very good team-friendly deal they just made. We just don't ask this broader take two steps back question of, why aren't there 12 teams right now bidding on Bryce Harper? And there should be.
At least, as I said before, at their age, at the age of Harper and Machado, and this seems to be what the White Sox are doing. I don't really know if it's going to work out for them or on a baseball basis, if it's the greatest idea. But what they seem to be saying in going aggressively after Machado is, yeah, we just lost 100 games. Yeah, we might not get back to the level of 2005 next year or the year after or the year after that. But we're talking about a decade commitment to a guy. So hopefully we'll get there at some point in that span. And that might not sound great to Machado, who just escaped Baltimore and who wants to sign on for more of that. But at the same time, it does show a certain fan-friendly commitment.
Yeah, that's the thing. I think we've lost, we view baseball so thoroughly now through the eyes of front office evaluators. And not at all as an entertainment product. You can go too far in one direction or the other. I think we've gone way too far in the idea of internalizing this idea that, oh, you can only make efficient moves. This is why it's bad to spend money on players and everything. We're all just victims to that right now. I don't expect there to be a Bill Veeck out there doing crazy things, but we got to have something fun happening in baseball. And we just don't have it at all. I'd love to see Bryce Harper in Colorado. I think that'd be so much fun. It's a short flight back to Las Vegas for him. He should love it.
I mean, I remember when the it's a weird to use the Mets in this example, they signed an obviously frail Pedro Martinez to a 4-year deal after he left the Red Sox. And I think everybody understood that it was not really a 4-year deal. What it was a 2-year deal, because that was all that he was likely to be healthy for, prorated over 4 years. They were just avoiding paying him essentially, you know, twice as much money as anybody had ever made in a single season to that point. And no, it wasn't a smart decision, because as it turned out, he had basically 1.5 seasons, and then they were paying for him to rehab basically and end his career. But at least their fans got that much for that period of time. And I would think that they might have made that back in ticket sales.
It didn't hurt him. I mean, look, to the extent the Mets became a tight organization, it had way more to do with Bernie Madoff than it had to do with Pedro Martinez. You know, heck, I'd love to see the Minnesota Twins bidding on Bryce Harper. Why shouldn't they? There are just a bunch of teams that could do this. And part of what happens is, part of that internalizing I talked about is whether teams are willing to do something versus whether teams are able to do something. That distinction has been completely lost. And the media, I think, is at large fault for this, because how often do you read a story saying, well, so-and-so team can't spend that much money? Well, who says?
Right.
We don't know that. And we really don't. And this is going back to stuff we all talked about on the internet 20 years ago about baseball teams aren't open with their finances, but they're not. We don't know the denominator in any of these equations. And baseball teams are very good about not telling us that. I am unwilling anymore. And I made a point, and I told Bill Baer and Ashley Varela, who worked for me, I said, we are not to put in any story, we're not to repeat uncritically the notion that so-and-so team cannot afford somebody. We don't know that. We can say they're not willing to spend that because that's what someone from the team says, or that's what's strongly speculated. But I will not say they can't do it, because I don't believe that to be true unless someone shows me the numbers.
Well, right. That's absolutely true. And the real question is what the word afford means in this context apply to the owner's profit margin, which, hell, he's entitled to set it wherever he wants. But is that essentially equivalent to his take home pay, as opposed to what the team could afford to put a good product on the field and still even, you know, not break even, do better than break even. And we don't have that information and we'll never have that information.
No, we have no idea. I mean, even an extreme case like the Marlins a few years ago, I mean, remember when they hired Ozzie Guillen and they got a bunch of players like Jose Reyes and everybody, and it looked like they were going for it or whatever. And that lasted about 6 months and they started trading everybody away. And after the trades happened, someone leaked some financial information about the Marlins. And it turns out that Jeff Loria was paying himself as a salary. We're not talking about profit from the business. We're just talking, he was paying himself a straight salary as a consultant or as a something else. He was paying himself $10 million. And that was twice as much as any Marlins player was making. When you've got boxes in within boxes within boxes on a team's balance sheet like that that none of us know anything about, who knows where they can they afford it or can they not, or are they simply unwilling to do it or can they not? I don't know, and I'm not going to be in the business of giving owners the benefit of the doubt on that stuff. There are extremes to this, of course. I mean, no one is going to give Adam Leand a $100 million contract. We don't do that because that's dumb. But at the same time, the idea that only two teams can afford Manny Machado or Bryce Harper is also ridiculous. So, you know, somewhere in between there, we need to, I won't say hold owners' feet to the fire because that's presumptuous and they don't care, but we don't need to be so credulous.
What you just mentioned with the sort of wearing multiple hats and drawing multiple salaries, wasn't that the case also with Frank McCourt when he owned the Dodgers, or he and his wife owned the Dodgers, and they had a separate corporation set up for the parking facilities and for the concessions and so on. And he was drawing an executive salary or a consultant salary for each and every one of those.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. The ways, and I don't mean ridiculous in that it's offending to my sensibilities. These are all private businesses. They're all closely held businesses. I think almost all of them. The Braves have a bit of a stock situation going on, but hardly anybody else does. I've always thought conceptually as just an overgrown car dealership. They are like the car dealership in your town. It makes a lot of money, but it is a relatively simple and a relatively small business. It's a family and a few close people and a few managers. And like I tell people that don't know anything about baseball, they think baseball teams are these like, you know, 1,000 employee in a giant office building sorts of thing. They're not. I mean, a front office is small and it's a very small organization, but they're also just as transparent as that car dealership in your town. You have no idea what the general manager and the owner make of that place. You have no idea what the top sales guy makes. And you don't care, but don't pretend that you know what their margins are. Don't pretend you know any more about a Major League Baseball team.
When Johnny Mercer served as the lyricist for the composer Richard Whiting, they hit a home run with Hooray for Hollywood, a song you still hear from time to time, especially bookending Oscar broadcasts. This song, Have You Got Any Castles, Baby, from the 1937 film Varsity Show with Dick Powell, has had some staying power too, albeit of a much lower key variety. This version is by the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra, and it seemed like a decent metaphor for, yeah, build me a decent team.
Have you got any castles that you want me to build, baby? Have you got any dragons that you want to have killed, baby? I'll get into my seven-league boots. I'll get into my bulletproof suits. I'll get out my revolver that shoots. And rat-a-da-ta-ta-da, down they'll go. Have you got any mortgages you want to have paid, baby? Have you got any villains that you want to have laid to rest? After all my adventures are through, and I bring home a dragon or two, you can tell all the papers that I did it because I love you.
And that's what they all say right before they raise ticket prices. We'll pause for a break here so we can all tend to our own castles, and I'll be back on the other side with more conversation with Craig Calcaterra, and I hope you will be too. See you then.
Thank you.
wrote up your provisional Hall of Fame ballot this week, and I enjoyed reading it. Well, except for this part, because when I got to the Roy Oswalt capsule, you wrote, Oswalt was one of the best when he was in his prime, but then his prime ended, as did his health and effectiveness. And sadly, that ended what I think was a Hall of Fame trajectory. And I thought, that's not about Roy Oswalt. That's about my career. And I take that very personally.
That's about everybody, man. We all are on a Hall of Fame trajectory when we're 25.
It really does feel that way. But I was curious about one aspect that you got into and why you think that is. And I thought you were very eloquent with everything that you said. Talking about Roger Clemens and Barry Bonds, who, according to the ballot trackers, seem to be scraping closer than ever to getting into the Hall of Fame this year. I don't know if they'll make it, but if they don't, it seems like it's going to be close. Why does it seem to you that they are bearing, this is a prejudicial characterization in a way, but a disproportionate amount of responsibility for the PEDs era?
I think that you will find, especially, I mean, and you know, because you were around and writing during all this period, and we're talking of the 2004 through 2008-9 period when PEDs were a big controversial topic and drug testing was new and the Mitchell Report came out and all that stuff was going on. There was a direct correlation to how much someone cared about drug use and whether or not someone was breaking records or threatening the legacies of the all-time greats. And Barry Bonds was a very easy guy. Well, he was easy to begin with because no one liked him. I mean, he was a very unlikable person. But if Barry Bonds wasn't breaking Mark McGwire's home run record, but people still considered it Roger Maris's home run record. If he wasn't breaking the single season home run record in 2001, and if he wasn't breaking the all-time home run record from Hank Aaron, I don't think people would care nearly as much about his drug use. But it was seen as if he was doing something sacrilegious. Roger Clemens, he didn't have quite those milestones. I mean, he had amazing milestones, don't get me wrong, but it's not like he was beating Cy Young's win total or anything like that. But it was the same thing. He was collecting 6 and 7 Cy Young awards and just putting himself squarely in the conversation of who are the 4 or 5 all-time greatest pitchers ever. When you're in that rarefied air and you're implicated in all this drug stuff, I think those guys were just taking it way more because they were seen as elevating their game to another level that was seen as unnatural. And did they do anything worse than someone who, in fact, I'd say they didn't do anything at all close to as worse as someone who was, say, cheating someone out of a 25th roster spot through drug use? I mean, that's probably a far worse ethical and moral situation, whereas people's lives were changed if they couldn't make a roster on the bottom end. Roger Clemens and Barry Bonds were going to be stars regardless and were stars regardless. So there's some of that going on. Sammy Sosa, though, I think probably has taken a bigger hit than anyone, than even Clemens or Bonds. Sammy Sosa is going to probably fall off the ballot this year. Guy had 600 home runs, and we can get into that whole game of, would Sosa have been a star like he was without drugs? We don't know. We don't even know what Sammy Sosa did or didn't do, unlike Clemens and Bonds, who at least went through some litigation.
I can make a circumstantial, I mean, I'm not alone in this. I'm not Sherlock Holmes or anything, but I've often said this, and it sounds glib, but it's true, that I'm looking at the shelf right now, but you'll recall that there used to be this book that came out annually called The Scouting Report, which was produced by Stats Incorporated. Every one of those books has a headshot for just about every player who was in the major leagues at that time. And Sammy Sosa's whole career is pretty much covered by the run. If you look at those Sammy Sosa headshots, again, I'm not saying this is dispositive. This is purely circumstantial, but his head starts like a normal head, and over the course of those headshots, if you lay them out year by year, one by one, he goes, and by the end, he's like a hot air balloon. And maybe there are other reasons that that could happen, but it certainly is suggestive in any case.
My thing that I wouldn't even have the job that I have today if it wasn't for getting into it very deeply, into steroids arguments with people. And it's the whole basis for people finding out who I was as a writer and everything, because I was talking about that stuff. For years, I have been sort of cast as an apologist for steroids users or a denier or something like that. And a lot of that is my own fault, because I've been making lawyerly arguments about, even if you assume blah, 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 blah. Don't get me wrong. I would bet a very large sum of money that Sammy Sosa used a lot of performance-enhancing drugs. I would bet all my money in the world on Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens and all the other guys that a lot of guys that people say, well, there's no proof. You know, you don't need that kind of proof. You can tell in a lot of guys. My thing is, I don't care in most situations.
Craig, I have to interrupt just to say that as soon as you use those lawyerly words, even if you assume, I just wanted to shout, there was two collusion. I'm sorry. Go. Go ahead. I got triggered. I'm sorry.
I understand. I have no doubt that, not much doubt anyway, that Sammy Sosa did stuff. The question that interests me is, one, do we care? Two, how much does it matter? What is the context in which this all happened and all that kind of stuff?
Right.
And when you unpack all that, and it's hard to unpack, especially when you're talking about sports, people like to go into binaries. This guy's good. This guy's evil. Black hat, white hat, whatever. So in a lot of ways, I've tried to extricate myself from steroids arguments over the last few years, very unsuccessfully, which is my own doing. But what do we think of that whole era? I think we're hopefully, at least in the Hall of Fame context, starting to get out of it a little bit. We're never going to get completely out of it because, you know, pretty soon we're going to have A-Rod on the ballot. And what happens, you know, there seems to be a pretty bright line being drawn now for guys who tested positive after the, after the testing regime came on. And, you know, what are we going to do with A-Rod? I think, if anything, Bonds and Clemens are pushing the limits of the moral judgment on steroids, and that by all rights, they shouldn't be getting 60% of the vote, and they're going to. And I think we're starting to see this. They were so good, and maybe we need to come off of what we were all moralizing about 10 years ago. I think it's happening a little bit, but then it's going to snap back because you got guys like Manny Ramirez and Palmeiro and soon A-Rod who tested positive under the testing regime, who I think are going to just be bright-lined out of it. It's a mess. It's just a huge mess. I just hope we can get Edgar and Mussina over the line this year.
Yes.
To clear out some of that backlog. It's going to be a mess forever.
Well, it always has been, just because there's no intellectual rigor or consistency to the Hall of Fame, and really never has been. And I don't want to drag us down the Harold Baines rabbit hole. That's the latest example of it. And I've said this before on this program, but I feel bad for Harold Baines, who was a very good hitter for the longest time and someone who I always felt good about watching. And if he got traded to a contender, I felt good about that for Harold Baines. Harold Baines, as far as I know, never did an offensive thing to anybody in his life, but he's become the symbol for this unsolvable puzzle.
He did very funny thing, though. Can I haven't been able to tell this story to anyone because it was like sort of passed me at the winter meetings this year. And this has nothing to do with anything. This just struck me as hilarious because Harold Baines, and this came up because it was the day after he was elected, and everybody was like, oh my God. And then there was the, oh, I feel so bad for Harold Baines because everyone's hating on him. But no one was hating on him, by the way. Everybody was hating on the Veterans Committee.
Right.
Everybody was saying Harold Baines is a nice guy. But there was this whole, oh, Harold Baines, nice guy. He didn't do anything to anybody. But a person I know who will remain nameless, who was at the winter meetings, told me this story. He's at Camelback Ranch a few years ago. I think it was like 5 to 7 years ago, at some point when Baines was doing something with the White Sox in spring training, as I imagine he does a lot. This guy was there with his son. My friend was a big Harold Baines fan because he's the right age to be a big Harold Baines fan in the early 80s. He walks up to Harold Baines, who's just hanging out by a batting cage or somewhere. And he goes up to him and he says, Mr. Baines, could you sign my son's ball or whatever? And Harold Baines looks at him and he says, Harold Baines? And he goes, yeah. And he says, I'm Daryl Boston. And my friend knows with mortal certainty that it's Harold Baines and not Daryl Boston. But Harold Baines, I think, was messing with him and trying to see if, like, my friend was being a racist or something like that. And he held to the, I'm actually Daryl Boston, for longer than was comfortable. And then finally was like, okay, fine, I'll sign your thing. And for some reason, that just struck me as hilarious because I can imagine the response to that could have gone wrong in 15 different ways, but it didn't. And anyway, that has nothing to do with anything. I just thought that was a funny story.
Can I tell you that, to use this term again, I'm again triggered because I don't think I've told this story on this show. Seriously, the most frightening, possibly career-ending experience that I've had in a major league clubhouse was that the Angels were visiting the Yankees, and my plan was to go into the visitor's clubhouse and interview Sean Figgins.
Oh, yeah.
So I head in, and there are two problems immediately, which is that everyone is naked and everyone basically has their back to me. I just picked the wrong moment to go in and I can't tell who's who. And unlike the Yankees clubhouse where there are names above the lockers, in the visiting clubhouse, they just have numbers above the lockers. So I look up and it's just 23, 72, 49, whatever. So now I'm not sure how to identify who I'm supposed to talk to. And then I had a bright idea, which is I remembered that in the press room, they had a printout of the Angels roster with yeah. the numbers. So I scurry out, I go get the printout, and I figure I can match the name with the number. So I come back in. There are two gentlemen of color, again, facing away from me, both in various states of undress. At one locker, it says that the number corresponds to Sean Figgins, and in the one next to him, it corresponds to Jose Guillen.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened, well, I walk up to the back of the gentleman who is supposed to be Sean Figgins, and I say, "Excuse me, Mr. Figgins, can I have a moment of your time?" And Jose Guillen turns around. Ooh. And start screaming at me, "Do I look like a Figgins to you?" And just blowing up. And it, whoever had typed up the roster had swapped the numbers.
Oh my God.
They're of very different builds. I understand that. But in that moment, I wasn't thinking about that.
People don't look, they don't know. It's hard. But guys are out of context. You see ball players in their uniforms with their caps on at their position all the time, and it's easy to forget. I get into a clubhouse and I have a hard time even with well-known players.
It was so embarrassing, and he's screaming at me at the top of his lungs. Instead of saying, "Hey, no, you've got the wrong guy," he's just going off on me. And I'm saying, "I'm sorry, I don't see very well. Look at these glasses I have on." Like, I'm really, really sorry. And at that point, and I don't want to say who it was, but the third locker over was a white player who said, "Yeah, they just look all alike to you, don't they?"
Oh, my God.
And I went, now, wait a minute, because now I really saw my career ending.
Oh, yeah.
I really saw writer in racial incident in clubhouse. I said to Jose Guillen, I'm like, "Calm down. I legitimately am partially blind. I'm sorry." And finally, he calmed down. He shook my hand and he said, "I'm sorry. It's just that Figgins is 5'6 and 180 pounds and I'm 6'1 and 210 or something." And like, yeah, I guess that should have occurred to me in the moment. And I said, "Well, I'm Steve Goldman and I'm 6'1 and 250. And he laughed. And that was the end of it. But that was a really scary 5 minutes for me.
Oh, God, that's the nightmare. That is the absolute nightmare. And I'm not in clubhouses very often. And to the extent I have been, it's been at spring training when there's, you know, 100 guys in there. And a lot of them might be crammed around lockers that don't correspond to their names and numbers and things like that. And it's hard enough, even for well-known players. It's if you don't see them with their cap on, you don't see their name on their back, you don't, you know, if you ever see them in street clothes, it's impossible. I'll stay at a hotel once in a while in a town where the visiting team happens to be staying. And, you know, you go down to the bar and you see a bunch of guys that you can tell just based on their look. Those guys are ball players.
Right.
I'm supposedly a professional baseball writer, and I'll just be with like a buddy who is just a friend and a baseball fan. And he'll look over there and say, "Hey, look, that's so-and-so. Look, Shlubotnik over there." I'm like, I don't know. Maybe I can't tell, you know? And he looks at me like I'm a moron. Like, I just don't do that very well. I have no idea.
No, it can be difficult. I make a point of going to clubhouses for things like Old Timers Day. They say Joe Shlubotnik's going to be here. And the picture in my mind of Joe Shlubotnik is from 1952. 85-year-old Joe Shlubotnik comes in. And sometimes it's kind of obvious who that is. But at other times, it's not clear which morbidly obese senior citizen is the one that I'm looking for. So I just stand there helplessly and hope that someone will identify themselves and by way of some gesture.
You'll never shake anybody up more than if you're in Scottsdale, Arizona at the Giants camp in spring training. Gaylord Perry is always there. And there's a table in the clubhouse, and it's always Gaylord Perry and Willie Mays are sitting there. And there's always some other Giants great. And they sort of hold court for much of spring training. And Gaylord Perry, if you see him now, I mean, he's an old guy. I mean, he's really old. And he was right. old when he retired. But, you know, he doesn't look a thing, unlike a lot of guys who just age into the older versions of themselves. Gaylord Perry is fundamentally different looking because he also has a big mustache now and everything. Even seasoned baseball writers, and for reasons that aren't important, I know what Gaylord Perry looks like now because I talk to him and everything. Well-known baseball writers come in there. "Hey, who's that guy next to Willie Mays?" "Oh, that's Gaylord Perry." "What?" Yeah, it's hilarious.
It's a Hall of Famer. But then their plaques don't look like them either.
No. So, plus, if you're sitting next to Willie Mays, you are far being crowded out of the spotlight automatically anyway. So
I had this weird Willie Mays question today in that, as I was saying earlier, I was at the MLB Network offices and they shoved me into an office that is normally split I guess in alternating fashion, by John Smoltz and Bob Costas. And there was a lot of Bob Costas-oriented memorabilia there. And there was a picture of Mays, Mantle, and Aaron, an older version of those guys. So it wasn't taken in the 50s or anything. Mantle and Aaron had signed it, and no one had bothered to get Mays. I felt the need to tell somebody. I didn't ultimately, but could someone take this off the wall and get it to Willie Mays while we have that opportunity? The lack of symmetry was really bothering me.
Oh, yeah, that would be bothersome. It's funny, when I have seen him in Scottsdale, he's always sitting there signing stuff. Like, maybe it's just luck, or maybe he does it all spring training, but every time I've gone there, he sets up at this table and there's a guy from MLB, you know, the guy who officially puts the little stickers on everything to make it official merchandise. And I know this because the first spring training I was in Scottsdale, I sat down at this table. There was nobody in the clubhouse, and I'm sitting there and I'm making notes and things about who I'm going to interview. And the MLB guy comes over. He goes, "You need to move from this table." And I didn't know who he was. And I said, the guy's like 25-year-old dude. I said, "Nah, I'm at this table. I'm not moving anyway." And he goes, "No, you're moving. You're moving because Mr. Mays is about to sit down here." I was like, "Oh, crap, get up. You got to get up." And Willie Mays comes in. I'm sitting here calling him Mr. Mays like 10 years later, and I'm still freaked out about this. You know, he comes in and he puts on those little glasses that have the sort of magnifying glasses and the spotlights on them, like for, you know, if you have trouble reading or something. He puts those on. A big stack of baseballs and baseball cards and pictures and things are right there. And he just signs them. He kind of like throws them over his shoulder. The MLB guy scrambles to get it and put the little sticker on it and everything like that. So I imagine you could just, Costas or someone could slip that picture in. And Mays will get it done.
If you're listening, Bob, get on this, okay? Because you have the access. I thank you very much for spending the time with me. It was way overdue. There are a few people in this business that I get to talk to on this show who I feel like if we lived in the same town or the same 30-mile vicinity or whatever, I'd be having these convivial conversations. And I'm so grateful that this podcast allows me the chance to simulate something like that with you here tonight.
I appreciate it too, and I feel the same way, Steve.
By the salinity of tomorrow, we have come to the end of today's episode. You can follow Craig Calcaterra on Twitter at Craig Calcaterra. Very easy. As for me, you can follow me at Go Stephen Goldman. Why Go Stephen Goldman? Because it's short for Going is Overrated Stephen Goldman. It's the inward journey that matters. I would like to take this opportunity to welcome our latest Patreon supporter to the Infinite Inning, Infinite Roll of Honor, Joao Madaleno Pereira. Thank you so very much. As the foregoing suggests, you can support the show on Patreon by visiting patreon.com/theinfiniteinning. You can also write us, by which I mean me, at theinfiniteinning@gmail.com. And there's a Facebook group. Go to Facebook, search Infinite Inning, knock. I will let you in, and you will be admitted to the one Facebook space which is not about how everyone you know is on vacation at a 4-star hotel in the Caribbean. Finally, if you find yourself with a spare moment and are generously inclined, please go to the podcatcher of your choice, Apple, iTunes, or what have you, and rate, review, and subscribe. It helps both the show and myself get the attention we both so very desperately need. And if your podcatcher doesn't let you do that, well, cry havoc and build a wall, or better yet, tear one down. Our theme song, which you are hearing now and have been listening to throughout the episode, was a co-composition of myself and Dr. Rick Mooring, who reminds you that our most precious graveyard is that which contains our buried dreams, but it is a graveyard nonetheless. Only beyond the berm may we pick a coffin and pray for the resurrection. Well, if the bookshelf doesn't shrug off the dictionary, causing it to crash to the floor and intimidate the cat with its weighty vocabulary, I'll be back next week with more tales and discussion from inside the Infinite Inning.